They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back to Magellan's at the Movies podcast. I'd say something self-deprecating, but I have a humongous ego, so I can't possibly take that even fake slight on my own talents. Instead, I'm just going to welcome my co-host, Elliot Mogolyans. And Elliot, I'm going to jump right on you with some banter, with a question. Have you seen the trailer for Scream 7, and what do you think?
I did see it. Way more dramatic, and it's not nearly as funny as I expect a Scream trailer to be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, it's pretty much an open secret at this point that Matthew Lillard is returning as at least one of the ghost faces. Yeah, somehow Matthew Lillard returned.
Great.
I don't know, man. If this movie ends up being good, I think it will be nothing short of proof of divine sanction. Like, God is a fan of Scream movies and has divinely intervened to make sure that this movie is good, because the deck is stacked against it.
Yeah, I think I was kind of surprised by how, I agree with how you put it, that the trailer very much highlights drama, specifically the drama of, Ghostface coming very aggressively, seemingly, for Sydney's daughter. Of course, this begs the question, why on earth is Ghostface killing two random people at the beginning of the movie if his intention is to kill a specific person? But whatever.
And just how Ghostface rolls. He kills random people.
He kills random people. I think I'm not particularly excited for it, because as in our review of Scream 6, I was a little harsh on it, and there's been a lot of stuff since then that makes this movie feel like it's kind of cobbled together out of bits and pieces to try and make some money here. It kind of feels like Jurassic World Rebirth, where they've got Kevin Williamson returning to do the screenplay, and he's also directing. In the same way Jurassic World Rebirth had the original screenwriter for Jurassic World and Jurassic World 2 returning and kind of tried to coast on the promise of that, meaning that the movie will be good. I'd be surprised if this was good. I'll probably still end up seeing it, but yeah, not particularly exciting. Elliot, the other thing I was going to ask you about is, I believe you saw Frankenstein, Guillermo del Toro's new movie. It's getting, buzz. It's going to be on Netflix, I think, next week. Elliot, what are your thoughts? Did you see it? Am I wrong? Am I teeing you up for nothing here?
Yeah, I saw it. We talked about it already.
Well, I just wondered if you wanted to share with the listening audience your thoughts.
I enjoyed it. I was a little disappointed, I have to say, because I think they made some changes to the source material that were not improvements. I'm gonna be fairly circumspect about this, to avoid spoilers, because I do think it is probably worth seeing, because Del Toro, he's a very visual director.
Yeah.
This is, right, a passion project of his, decades in the making, or at least decades in the imagining for him. I think it is a great marriage of director and material. I think he kind of makes it too much his own, if I'm honest. That sounds harsh, but I think that there are some Del Toroisms in this movie that kind of chafe against the rest of the movie, which is, right, relatively accurate.
Yeah.
So I still enjoyed it. I still thought it was an entertaining. Dude, the theater I saw it in was packed.
Really?
Like, it wasn't the biggest screen in the world, but it was a full house.
Wow.
Which I was surprised about, but I guess Kansas City, it's an indie theater, right? The hipsters were crawling out of the woodwork.
I guess, yeah.
But anyway, that's my opinion. I saw it with the other Magellan sibling, who's not Lydia, Ryan, and he did not like it.
Oh, wow.
He gave it a 5 out of 10, I believe, which isn't, it's not terrible, but he basically had the exact same problems that I did, only he felt them more acutely. So yeah, there's his opinion.
Wow. That is a really low score for him. He's kind of he's goofy. I don't know. Anyway, that's all. Those are the two banter things that I had, Elliot. Do you have anything you want us to discuss before we discuss the movie?
Well, I just want to hit continuing trailers for Stranger Things Season 5. I have to be honest, I'm struggling to muster up a whole lot of anticipation over here.
Yeah.
I'm hardly dreading it. I'm planning on watching it. But I feel like I was kind of drained by Seasons 3 and 4. They just felt a little wheel-spinny. It feels like the premise, this show has kind of gone beyond its premise. And now, right, we're dealing with end-of-the-world type stuff and magic evil monsters from another dimension, which was present, right, in the first season and in the second season. I just feel like it's gotten to a point where I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a little overwhelming. So yeah, apparently the episodes, they're pretty long. And the last one, it's like, it's a feature length film. They're even going to release it in theaters. I think on the day before New Year's Eve, they'll be releasing the last episode in theaters. So you can just watch it and it'll be like, it's like 2 hours long. So you watch it, and then that'll come to an end. I'm certainly interested. This is definitely an event, right? Yeah. This is the conclusion to one of Netflix's golden eggs.
Yeah. I'd make a joke here about House of Cards, but the joke is redacted for reasons.
Wow.
But I agree. I didn't love seasons 3 and 4, which is too bad because I adore season 1. I think it's one of my favorite seasons of television.
Let's not even talk about season 2.
Well, season 2 is just kind of like there.
Yeah.
And
it's insane. I'm sorry. I know I keep on interrupting here, but no, it's fine. Insane that they have they mentioned Samwise dying. Since he died? I feel like nobody's brought him up since his death.
She was a rebound. She wants to be with Hopper, so she's forgetting that guy she was with briefly, who was, like, so fantastic.
I mean, that's fine, but gosh. Let's have justice for whatever his name was.
Well, and I think that's kind of what... I don't know. I don't want to get too in the weeds here. This isn't the Stranger Things podcast, but I do feel like because the seasons haven't felt like they've been building to something, like season 4 is really the only season that was aggressively building towards what we're going to see in season 5. Seasons 2 and 3 feel very wheel spinny and meaningless. And so I can't really get that excited because I'm like, this isn't like the culmination of the whole story. This is the culmination of season 4's story, which I didn't like and thought was like the worst season of the show yet.
You thought season 4 was the worst?
Yeah, I really don't like season 4.
I mean, I don't love it. I wouldn't say it's the worst, but that's interesting. I will say I like that they have... See, this is just becoming the Stranger Things podcast. I like that they have a firm antagonist with agency, who's not just a monster. Sure. And who's not the mind flayer, who's, right, interesting, but it doesn't really do anything aside from... What does it do? Just hang out?
Yeah.
And look just, intimidating?
Yeah. Feed on evil?
Yeah. So it's nice to... I mean, the design, when I first saw the Mind Flayer, I was like, that is so cool. It looks awesome. Yeah. It just doesn't do much. But it's nice that telekinetic zombie guy, as he's referred to in our family, or TZG, it's nice to have TZG because he's more than just a faceless, nameless, motiveless threat.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is nice, I guess, but... Anyway, this is the Stranger Things podcast, but if you want us to do an episode on the Stranger Things, feel free to send us an email. We could probably swing it as we're doing special episodes coming up. But anyway, Elliot, in your pursuit of having us do the least relevant movies possibly conceivable, you've picked another heck of a movie. You have picked 2009's 2012. The aptly named 2012, directed by Roland Emmerich. Elliot, give us a window into your thinking here. Why'd you pick this movie, and what's the deal for those of us who maybe were not around in 2009 for this smash hit of a film?
Well, I like genre movies, okay? I guess, for lack of a better term, literary fiction as much as the next guy. But if you ask me where my heart lies, as evidenced by, right, my favorite movies and books, my heart lies with genre fiction.
Mm.
And I feel like we haven't done really a disaster movie. The case could be made for Godzilla or Godzilla Minus One. But kaiju movies, I would say, are kind of like a subgenre of disaster movies.
Mm-hmm.
And who better to turn to in our hour of need than the master of disaster, the king of catastrophe, Mr. Roland Emmerich himself, with what is one of his most disastrous disaster movies. In 2012, it's just all over, guys. It's just all over. It's a worldwide catastrophe of unimaginable proportions.
Yeah.
So if you didn't know, this is based on the 2012 phenomenon, which wrongly held the Mayan long count calendar, as it's known, predicted the end of the world on December 29th, wasn't it? 2012. It's a very silly idea that I definitely was not terrified of as a child when I heard about it. But Roland Emmerich looked at that and he was like, this concept needs to be made into a feature film. So that's what he did. And my goodness, didn't he, though? Because this movie made over $700 million.
What?
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Nathan. This movie was very successful. Not critically. Critically, it received pretty much a shrug. But in terms of box office, this was a big old smash hit for Mr. Emmerich. And I watched this movie once when I was in high school on the TV with our father. And I could not remember a single thing about it. I was effectively watching the movie for the first time.
Yeah.
And I just thought, let's do it, man. Let's face the end of the world head on. The end of the world as imagined by this this man, Roland Emmerich, and a bunch of new age weirdos, and let's have it out. Let's see what we got. So there it is. Nathan, I'm curious. I'm very curious. I'm always curious to hear what you think about movies that don't include actors just staring blankly into the middle distance for minutes at a time.
That's so weird.
So Nathan, what do you think? Do you think this movie could have used more actors staring blankly into the middle distance for minutes at a time while sad music plays?
I think I don't appreciate your characterization of my favorite types of movies. I would not say that they only include characters staring into the middle distance. Sometimes it's characters staring into the middle distance for minutes at a time after someone says a question that they should definitely respond to with words instead of with poignant stares. That's also very present in these movies. But what did I think of 2012?
The movie, not the year. I don't care what you're thinking on the year was.
I can't remember a lot from 2012, the year. But for the movie, I think this is really bad. I'm personally offended that you asked us to do this for the podcast. I was maybe going to be a little more nice to the movie, but learning that it made $700 million from presumably conscious, awake, alive human people, I'm going to be very harsh on this. I think this is the worst qualities of the disaster movie. And we'll talk. You said you love genre movies. I love genre movies as well. I think they're a fascinating sandbox to play in. And I think this movie is a fascinating look at how to do almost every single piece of those poorly, or at least as poorly as they've ever been done in. Maybe I'm being too harsh here. This is the issue with describing things. I think it's not very good for a lot of reasons, but, you know, we can get into those as we do the review. What do you think of this? I mean, you're the one who picked this thing.
Well, I did not have quite so extreme a reaction. I honestly didn't have much of a reaction at all. I would have to side with the critics who gave this movie a shrug. You know who didn't give this movie a shrug? Mr. Roger Ebert, who gave it 3.5 stars. What? Which means that Roger Ebert thinks that this movie is just shy of being perfect.
That's crazy.
That's interesting. Nathan's learning so much about 2012 that he doesn't like.
This is all new. I was reading the trivia section on IMDb before we started this episode. None of this came up. A 3.5? He scales down a 4, by the way. For the listening audience who aren't familiar, Roger Ebert does out of 4. So yeah, 3.5 out of 4. This movie's in rarefied air.
Also, I was fact-checking myself, and it's actually a little bit worse. Over 700 million doesn't quite cover it because the actual number is 791 million.
Oh my gosh. Basically 800.
Yeah. But anyway, I cannot account for that $791 million from this movie. I thought that it was instructive in that I felt like it failed in the way that disaster movies very often tend to fail. I feel like this was a case study in the, I'm not going to say problems, but the struggles or the obstacles inherent in making a disaster movie. And that's kind of where I'd like to start here. I'm just going to dive right in, as Nathan loves to say.
Do it, yeah.
With the disaster itself, because that's what people are coming for. That's what people spent $791 million on, is seeing the steel bend and the glass shatter and the earth upheave into the air and crack apart. I was going to say like Doomsday, but it is Doomsday.
Yeah.
And I think that when I say this movie is indicative of what people who set out to make disaster movies often fall victim to, is that disaster movies are very vulnerable to diminishing returns. That there's the buildup is usually accepted as, like, we have to have, okay, guys, we have to have humans in this movie. Just needs to happen so we can have, like, a viewport to the action. And I often find that Roland Emmerich does the buildups pretty well, at least in terms of building up the anticipation. And I think it's done fine here. I mean, these are not good characters, but they're acceptable.
Sure. Yeah.
And you're just waiting for that, the tip of the spear of the disaster is like the first night out in a superhero movie, right?
Yeah.
Like in Batman Begins, when Batman first shows up on the docks.
Yeah.
That's the first night out, and it's always in a superhero movie. And the tip of the spear of the disaster is when no one's prepared, and it's protracted. It's a big, long, muscular sucker of an action set piece. In this case, they're driving a limo through Los Angeles, right?
Yeah.
And the earth, it's just falling apart, man. The tectonic plates are like pulling away from each other, and LA is sliding into the sea. It's absolute pandemonium. And that's fine. It's a good sequence, I think. But then the next sequence of destruction is almost identical.
Mm-hmm.
In that this first sequence is, we need to escape destruction and get to a plane that will take us to our next destination. And the next one is, we need to escape this destruction and get to a plane that will take us to our next destination. Mm-hmm. And then the next one is, we need to escape this destruction and get to a plane that will take us to our next destination. And each time I felt less invested in the stakes, as I became inured to just mind-boggling scales, levels of destruction. I became more aware of the fact that the movie was giving me the same thing over and over again. And the movie failed to come up with something, I don't know what. I admit it's a difficult problem, but something to vary the movie so we're not just watching, right? The Yellowstone explosion is fine, but it's not that much different from LA falling apart.
Yeah.
And so I thought that the first, like, I don't know, what is that, like 45 minutes of the movie were fine, but then there's over an hour left of the movie at that point. When I paused the movie and I saw I was only halfway through, I was like, are you serious? Why is this movie 2 hours long? Movie did not furnish a good answer, by the way.
It's not just 2 hours long. It's 2.5 hours long. This movie is longer than 12 Angry Men, which isn't a particularly long movie, but, like, how? And, yeah, I'd agree with you that all disaster movies follow similar sorts of things, and they're aware of this problem that you're talking about, where we're gonna see a lot of people die just by the nature of the threat that is posed in this movie. And so in order to get you to care about people, they have typically, like, a very large cast, or at least a large enough cast that we can see a lot of different avenues into caring about things that happen. And this movie does the most half-hearted, basic attempt at doing this that I've ever seen. So many characters are introduced solely so they can say, oh, my son, who is main character number two, I love him, I haven't talked to him enough, oh, geez, that's my bad, oh, let me talk to him 10 seconds before I die because of a tsunami. And they only serve to make this meager attempt to try and make you care one iota about the worst characters in the history not been this. Again, as soon as I get going, it's all hyperbole. I'm trying to not do that. But it's a very weak attempt, in my opinion, to try and solve this problem that you're talking about, to get you invested in action that revolves around very few people surviving something that is killing a lot of people. And it's so weak. I mean, when the two dads who were on the cruise ship ended up dying, I was like, why did we even introduce these as characters? And kind of same with near the tail end of the movie when Satnam, the guy who kind of first discovered this problem, calls the main character as he's about to die just to be like, hey, by the way, I'm about to die. And I'm like, why are we doing this? It kind of reminds me of, this isn't going to land for a lot of people, but Elliot, you remember those games we would play as kids where we would play Isin? Which was, I'm not going to get into all of it, but do you remember how the story of it, at least to my recollection, was so much the characters stand around talking, which they didn't do very much of because we, you know, didn't have much energy for that sort of thing. And then a threat would show up and we'd run around the house escaping the threat and we'd stop, presumably because we had escaped the threat. We'd talk for maybe one more minute and then, oh, what's this? Another threat. Guess we gotta run around the house again. It feels the same as watching this movie, that it's like, oh, we gotta, just like you said, we gotta drive a car to get to a plane, and then we'll take off in the plane, and oh dear, look at this, another threat, time to drive a car to get to a plane. And it's so lacking in creativity, right? That there's no, I think this every time you have a movie, and it's got pretty much the same threat, you have to find ways to make each new action set piece or new action scene somehow unique from the previous ones, right? If you think about John Wick and all of the different action scenes in that series, right, all of them fundamentally boil down to John's got to kill a whole bunch of people. But they do so many different things to try and make each of those action piece set pieces different and unique. Like here he's fighting in a dance club or something. Here he's using a different weapon. He's using a sword. He's using a shotgun. He's using some crazy shotgun with fire breath or whatever it is that he uses in that one scene. Right. And they do this to try and make it interesting. Because if it's just, oh, John's got to shoot a bunch of guys in the head, it kind of wears on, which they don't do it perfectly, in my opinion. But this isn't a review of John Wick. And I think this movie just does a really terrible job because, yeah, the first three action scenes are basically the exact same thing three times with, like, a different CGI threat following the car.
Yeah, it's not very creative.
Yeah.
And the movie suffers from it. I like when they're at the third plane, or it's the same plane for the first two, sections. Yeah. The first two, we need to get to a planes. The big cargo plane that they use to try to get to China, features and lets all observe a moment of silence for the most committed, the most dedicated, the most noble air traffic controller of all time who refused to abandon his post even as the ash cloud of the Yosemite supervolcano was closing in. He stayed at his post. He upheld his responsibility to the very end. Like, the last words he said, aside from, or whatever he said there, was, you do not have clearance. So, yeah. I salute you.
Incredible. Sir. Incredible. And I mean, this is what I'm talking about, that this movie is all of the worst qualities of disaster movies. That people are constantly making ridiculous and poor decisions. When whatever the main character, John Cusack's character is, when he went back into the RV to get the
Jackson
maps.
Jackson Curtis.
Of course, Jackson Curtis. When he went back into the RV to get the maps, I was like, bro, just grab all the maps. You can sort through them later. Why are you shuffling through them to grab the specific map you need? It's ridiculous. I will say, this is a positive thing, though. The science checks out. This is actually exactly how neutrinos work. This is exactly how solar flares work. This is exactly how the tectonic plates that make up our Earth work. I did hours of research, but far less research than they did for this movie, and it all checks out. This is 100% factual. What would happen if any of the things... No, I'm joking here, if you couldn't tell from my tone of voice. You know, this is just another area where every disaster movie has terrible science. One of my favorite science things ever was someone was asked, how accurate is the movie Armageddon? And they said, well, asteroids exist. So that's one thing that they've got correct. Nothing else. And this is a similar movie. I mean, they're throwing some nonsense science words at you to try and make you think, like, a neutrino, oh, jeepers, that sounds concerning.
It's like the line from Gravity Falls when Sue says, that sounds just sciencey enough to be true.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, you know, it's just another area where the movie is doing, in my mind at least, the bare minimum and nothing more. And we gave them $800 million for it.
Well, I don't really care about scientific accuracy. Unless it's like, well, I don't know. It didn't really bother me. I did like that the one professor guy, the guy who wears a bow tie, said, like, all of our scientific progress or knowledge or something, and the Mayans predicted this thousands of years ago. What does he refer? Does he mean that the Mayans sat down and were like, the neutrinos, guys, they're going to overheat the Earth's crust because of solar flares? Like, what did the Mayans predict exactly?
They knew, bro. They knew.
Well, again, somehow they did it because the long count calendar has nothing to do with, is not an end times prophecy. That's all interesting. What are neutrinos?
Bro, I don't know. Something, I think they're just a subatomic particle, or they could be just an atomic particle. But I don't know. Okay, they said at the beginning they usually just go
see,
through
I
things.
Spent like 20 minutes reading about the long count calendar on Wikipedia. I see you didn't do the same for neutrinos.
Dang, my bad. I didn't realize that was our respective fields we had to research before a movie.
Well, I don't know. I want to ask, so it's a little difficult to know where to go from here. I want to circle back just real quickly and say that I definitely agree. This movie, if this script was handed to me and they were like, could you please edit this? I would make pretty liberal use of my red pen and I would cross out substantial sections. I would cross out entire parts like the father guy that you were talking about who's on the cruise and the Indian scientist who calls his friend and is like, I'm dying. See ya.
Yeah, crazy.
It kind of feels like a first draft in that regard. Because the old rule of thumb, in case any of you writers out there were wondering, is second draft equals first draft minus 10%. Mm. It's not a hard and fast rule, but it's kind of something to shoot for. Or who knows, maybe the first draft of this movie was like 4 hours long. But I want to say that I want to say something that I liked about this movie. Okay. Aside from, I thought that the first action set piece was fine. Although, the special effects did not hold up, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And there were times where I was like, that's pretty rough. Especially when, for some reason, they're flying. They've gotten to their plane and they're flying at like almost street level as if to taunt all the people who are dying. Like, hey, see you, suckers.
Yeah.
That shot was rough, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But I'm saying something I like.
Yep.
I thought that, and I'm not even, I'm going to really struggle with this name. I thought that she would tell Ejiofor.
Yeah.
I'm really sorry, Mr.
It's tough.
C.
It's a tough name, yeah.
I thought that he was giving a performance that this movie, frankly, did not deserve. It's not like brilliant or anything, yeah. But he's trying. He's putting in some effort.
I thought it was
really good. It's not right. It's not on the level of 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
he's doing more for this movie than he needed to.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is another aspect that I'm going to start saying a positive about the movie, but it's going to end up as a negative because his story represents maybe the most interesting aspect of the movie, right? That he discovers in 2009 that this event is going to transpire in 2012. And so he contacts the president, and the president contacts the other heads of state, and they all kind of come up with a plan to, right, ensure the survival of humanity through this horrible event. And I think, I mean, that's an interesting place to start. And there's a lot of great sci-fi movies that start in that spot of here's an insane world-ending event. I mean, Interstellar is an incredible movie based out of that same idea of, you know, how do we avoid this horrible event? And his character and his kind of storyline represents one of the more interesting aspects that he kind of discovers that they've basically only tried to save the rich and powerful on the earth instead of everyone else on the earth. And he's aghast to discover this, and he's kind of trying to fight the system to save as many people as he can, which kind of late in the game to be doing this at this point, but he's doing his best. And it's interesting, but again, it's so half-baked and feels so like it's just there. There's so many moments in this movie that feel like it's trying to say something meaningful or poignant. I think of like the scene in the Vatican where the Italian head of state has stayed behind, and so everyone's in that courtyard in the Vatican City and the Pope is praying as everything falls apart and they die. I will also say, I noticed, just because I've seen a couple of movies set inside the Vatican and specifically set inside the Sistine Chapel, that when it showed the Sistine Chapel, I was like, that's not what it looks like. I haven't been inside of it, but I've seen two movies, one of which was, I think, filmed inside the Sistine Chapel or filmed inside an almost one-to-one replica. That's not what it looks like.
Well, I didn't realize that the dome of St. Peter's Basilica is so freaking huge.
Yeah, well, that was another part where the CGI was not doing a great thing, because I agree. The dome came off and was crushing people or whatever. And
I'm pretty sure if a dome of that size fell off a building, it probably wouldn't roll. It would just, like, crumble apart.
No, it was really built very well.
It was built like a tire.
Yeah, exactly. But it feels like the movie is making half-hearted stabs about being about something, quote-unquote, and it just feels so weak and so pitiful that it's like, what, you know, what could you even conceivably be trying to say here about religion or about conspiracies or about humanity?
I don't think it's trying to say anything. And I think that this is another staple of Roland Emmerich movies, is that they often conclude on corny, sentimental platitudes about people coming together. Right? People are constantly, I think in multiple Roland Emmerich movies, there's a line to the effect of, we've put our petty differences aside.
Yeah.
They say it in Independence Day Resurgence. Pretty sure they say something like it in this movie. I wouldn't be surprised if they said something like it in The Patriot, or whatever that movie is, all about the American Revolution.
That's him?
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. It's interesting who the movie condemns and who the movie kind of tries to awkwardly cut out exceptions for, because Mr. Chiwetel, what's his character's name?
That's a good question. You'd love to know.
Adrian
Helmsley. Yeah.
Adrian mourns the death of the administrator of the Louvre or something, and he suspects, like, are we killing people to keep the secret? To keep this secret? And he's like, no, we would never do that. Then it transpires that, yes, that's what they were doing. And the movie kind of tries to pin all of that on his superior. I can't remember what his character's name is either, but the guy.
Yeah.
What is he, the chief of staff?
I can't remember.
Whatever he is, the pseudo-antagonist guy. And the movie never really addresses it, but I was thinking, are we saying that the president didn't know about this or something? Like, we're trying to preserve a heroic, humble role for Danny Glover as the president and sort of shunt all of this shady stuff onto this guy. And I was thinking, okay, guys, come on. I think the president was probably involved in these assassinations.
Yeah. No, I felt the same way, because some of the other characters' deaths and the way they were handled, I was like, is this...
Dude, pour one out for Gordon.
Yeah, Gordon dies in a fairly brutal fashion. And then the Russian guy, when he dies saving his kids or whatever, there's like a slow-mo of him falling. I was like, why does he get a slow-mo? And Gordon got nothing. Gordon gets squat. And even there's some like comic moments, like when Sasha dies in the plane, that it kind of stops at the edge of a cliff and he's like, oh, whew. And then it starts to tilt forward and he dies. And I was like, that feels kind of mean-spirited. And so it doesn't feel like the movie has a cohesive sense of who it's trying to absolve and who it's trying to get us to care about and who it's trying, because it feels kind of like Gordon just dies because
we need to get Jackson back together.
Yeah,
with his ex-wife.
Jackson has to get back with his ex-wife, who, by all accounts, has no interest in doing that with him. Like, nothing in this experience. There's never a scene where she's like, "Man, I feel like I've underestimated you, and now I would revisit a relationship with you." Although he does kiss her after Gordon, like, moments after Gordon dies, he kisses her before he goes off to maybe die himself, which I think is a crazy thing to do.
Well, at that point, she doesn't even know that Gordon's dead. She hasn't even asked about it.
That's true. That's very
true. So for
true.
All she knows, she's actually cheating on her boyfriend.
Perfect, perfect. But again, this just goes into exactly what I was saying before, that it feels like the movie is making half-hearted stabs at a million different things and failing to do all of them. It's maybe the epitome of jack-of-all-trades, master-of-none, but I would say it's just incompetent doofus at all trades, master-of-none. Wow. Take that, Roger Ebert. 3.5 stars.
excuse me.
Excuse you.
Let's see. What else is there? You haven't really talked about the destruction. The thing for which this movie was awarded those 3.5 stars. Did you get anything out of any of it? Like, the first one when they're driving through LA. And another strange comedic moment. These two old ladies crash their car. And I think it's supposed to be funny. I mean, it was a little funny.
I think a part of this is just disaster movies aren't for me. I don't get much of anything out of seeing cities destroyed. I don't get any sort of like thrill from it. I think if anything, there was one moment when it shows LA slipping into the Pacific Ocean where I was like, that's crazy. That's an insane, insane thing to happen. And that's just like such an inconceivably awful thing that I don't know what I'm supposed to feel about it. It looks neat. Like, I think that's one of the few places where this, I mean, the CGI is not terrible, but it's never good enough to make me go, wow, that's great CGI. It's always just good enough for me to go, wow, that's neat. It is kind of cool that Cristo Redeemer, our homeland, gets a shout out as we see Rio destroyed and Christ the Redeemer falls apart.
So poignant.
I mean, at the very least, it's a different landmark to see get destroyed than we usually see. I mean, usually it's just Statue of Liberty, Golden Gate Bridge, let's knock out the hits, Eiffel Tower. Crystal Redeemer, I think, is a great pick for a thing to see get destroyed. But I don't, it does very little for me, and especially when it doesn't look incredible. My reaction is mostly just, dude, sick, bro, I guess.
It does feel a little weightless because it's so clearly CGI. The CGI isn't good enough to make it feel impactful, and obviously it lacks the visceral impact of practical effects, right? Mm. I actually think it's pretty easy to tell the difference between a CGI explosion and a practical explosion, even a miniature practical explosion. There's just something more tactile. There's just something about the texture of it on screen that it's hard to replicate with CGI, and certainly it's not replicated here.
Yeah, I do.
Although I thought it was
what
when the subway comes out, I thought that was interesting, and it lands and it explodes for some reason. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud here. I just thought it was interesting. I thought it was I feel like I'm kind of damning with faint praise here, but I thought it was a neat idea because the whole thing that's happening is, right, the Earth is kind of like raising, like the tectonic plate is tilting over. Yeah. And so having a subway, yes, just like fly out of this column of Earth, I thought that was a good idea. So good job, whoever thought
I mean
of that.
I can do the same thing, because I think the concept of these giant arcs that they're in at the end of the movie is a neat idea. And like I said before, it is an interesting philosophical or ethical sort of question where it's like, surely they couldn't create enough arcs to save everyone. And so how on earth would you determine who gets to come and survive an event like this? I mean, that's just an impossible moral calculus that I don't see how anyone could feasibly make. But again, the movie doesn't make any gains. Like you said, it's meaningless platitudes is all it says. It's like, yeah, it'd be great if everyone could be saved. I'm like, that's true. Hopefully we all feel that way. But like, that's not that's not diving any deeper into an interesting question. That's just being like, you know, like those memes of, right, people who watch a movie and they're like, dang, just learned about, you know, apartheid. That's crazy. No one should experience that. It's like, that's great, but that's not helpful or interesting.
I agree. And in that moment, as we get closer to the arcs, that is really when the characters needed to come to the forefront, come into their own, and that's when we needed to shift our focus away from disaster, which they do. There's less disaster in the second half, but the stuff that they focus now on are these cardboard cutout characters. I mean,
yeah.
Another staple of Roland Emmerich movies, divorce. And I guess broken families. I wonder if that's connected to anything in Roland Emmerich's personal life. I don't know.
I'm not here to speculate.
I agree. Shouldn't have even brought it up. It's just, gosh, you've actually talked me down. But
good.
The movie's not very good.
I think, and
we really should. I feel like this is an example of when I decided that we should watch a Burton movie, and I went with Pee Wee Herman. And over the course of the episode, I kept on coming to the realization, really should have just done Beetlejuice. Same thing, really should have just done Independence Day.
Well, and if we wanted to be really funny, we could have done his version of Godzilla. Because that is just... It's one of my fondest memories as a kid was watching that, and I thought it was so cool. And then watching it as an adult, I was like, this sucks, bro. This is terrible.
Really? It as an adult. I just remember it being the best thing I'd ever seen in my life. And feeling so legitimately sad. I felt like every time I watched the movie, because I was a dumb kid, right? I would in some way like hope that Godzilla would make it in the end.
I felt
so sad for him at the end when he was tangled up in the bridge. And I didn't really think about all the people he'd killed and how his existence threatened human life. But every time that happened, I was like, surely this time he'll make it out. But it never happened.
Yeah. I will say also, on kind of meaningless notes about this movie, is it brought back my memories of watching PBS documentaries about the Yosemite supervolcano or whatever and how concerned I was that it would go off and kill me. That I remember them showing a map of, like, if it goes off, this is where the ash cloud will be. I'm like, oh my goodness, that covers Iowa. I live there. I'm gonna die, bro. And I remember how dramatic they made it. Like, every break to commercial, it was like, next time, see how the clock is ticking. See how long we have left until America is covered with smoke. I'm like, oh no. Are we even going to make it out of the commercial break? I'm going to see a cloud over the horizon in moments.
That's insane. I had the exact same experience. And those documentaries, they went hard, dude. They had, like, renders of cities being destroyed and stuff.
It was like the beginning of Terminator 2, watching these documentaries. It was ridiculous.
Well, I remember watching something about... What was it? I think it was like a severe magnetic storm from the sun, solar flares or something. And then afterwards, I would like look at the sun to like try to see it coming, to see if I needed to take cover or something.
Yeah.
Haven't they said that Yosemite is not actually on track to erupt, or like it's unlikely that it will erupt anytime in the near future or something?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they've said like it's never going to happen.
All that worrying for nothing.
I know, right?
I mean, like I said, or like I implied, and which I'm now confirming, I was terrified of the 2012 thing as a kid. When I first heard about it, I was like, the world's going to end in 2012? No!
And then you learned about neutrinos, and you were like, oh, no!
No! Not neutrinos!
Anyway, we can get to ratings here. We don't have to keep joking around.
Yeah, there's nothing really else to say. Like, does anyone want to talk about the score to 2012?
They don't even have a good song. In terms of actors and characters, I mean, all these characters outside of the one you already mentioned, Adrian, are pretty one note and meaningless. Woody Harrelson is okay as a crazy conspiracy guy. Or I guess just a crazy guy. He's not, his conspiracy is true, so that's not a conspiracy. He just is, I think he is still a little off his rocker. But yeah, I don't have anything else to say about any of the pieces of this film.
Well, let's give it a rating.
Yep.
I've talked myself down. This movie is clearly not good. I never thought it was good, to be honest. I just thought it was a bit of the nothing burger. But actually, it turns out to be a nothing burger with expired mayonnaise.
Ugh.
Which I don't like. Does anyone? I'm not going to go through the whole thing again. The movie's not very good. It failed to iterate beyond the initial disaster. The characters are nothing. I can't give you any good reason to watch this movie. It's not incompetently made, and Adrian is acted well, and occasionally I find it somewhat interesting, unlike Nathan, to watch things get destroyed. So I'm going to give it a D plus.
I'm going to give it, I think, the lowest score I've ever given a movie on this podcast. And I think I'm going to give it a 2.7 out of 10. Which we might have
you've ever given?
I think it's the lowest. Because disaster movies aren't for me. And so this is the kind of movie that if it was a horror movie, I would maybe be able to get invested because I like that genre and I find it interesting to see the ways a movie plays out its genre. But I just don't care about disaster movies. I can't think of, you're going to see when I recommend it, that I couldn't really think of a disaster movie I liked to recommend for this. So there's just nothing for me here. And it just really irritates me. I'm glad I talked you down. I can't believe it made this much money.
Well, I don't know. I guess people were, it's like I said, the 2012 phenomenon was a phenomenon. So yeah. I guess it was just tapping into that.
Yeah. In 2009.
Well, it's been a thing since, right? 5000 BC or whenever.
Yeah.
Whenever they made the calendar. I already gave it a rating. I don't know what I'm doing here.
Let's talk recommendations. Yep.
I already mentioned the movie. I'm going to cheat a little bit and recommend Roland Emmerich's best movie, Independence Day. I think that Independence Day is a rare example of a disaster movie that does manage to get over the hump of the tip of the spear. I've actually written a review for this movie that's on the blog if you want to check it out. But basically what I said is that I think the Independence Day shows admirable restraint in the buildup to the alien attack. And then afterwards, they introduce elements of horror with the aliens. They have dogfighting between fighter jets and the alien fighter jets, I guess. They don't just retread the aliens blasting a city and things just exploding. And the sequence of things just exploding is great. It's used with practical effects. I love the way they did it is they made a big, like, miniature set of a city, and then they tilted it to a 90-degree angle and set off a bomb, not like an actual bomb, an explosive at the base. So the fire did, and then when you, tilt the footage back horizontally, it looks like the fire is spreading out equally, because when it exploded, the fire, of course, went up through the city as it was. It's very clever.
Yeah.
And it does have the weight that you want from explosions and things being destroyed. And it's fun. We watch it every 4th of July. It's a good time.
No, I agree. I really like that movie. I could have sworn we reviewed it for the podcast, but maybe I was just thinking of your thing and maybe I recommended it for some other movie. But my recommendation is going to be a disaster movie that I think really nails both the human cost of a disaster as well as tells a pretty compelling story through the story of the disaster. That's going to be James Cameron's Titanic. Presumably you have heard of this movie. It did huge numbers. It has been hugely influential in pop culture. It won Best Picture, and I think a lot of that is deserved. It's not a perfect movie. I think it's a little overlong, but I think it has such a great sense of drama, such a great sense of why a disaster is compelling, because we're seeing people die. And I think the final stretch of this movie, as the Titanic is sinking and people are desperately trying to get into a boat or get saved, is just so fantastic. And most of it's done, like Elliot said, with practical effects, which look fantastic. And it's got great performances. I think the central story is very compelling. I think there are I think there's a reading of it that it is that is not as disingenuous as some readings that I've seen of the Titanic love story, that I think it is a very compelling love story that's about maybe a little bit more than just falling in love, but maybe figuring out how to really be alive in a sense. And I think it's really great. I think it deserves it. I'm a bit of a James Cameron hater, so you know it's good if I'm coming on here and telling you to go watch it.
I agree. I can second that recommendation. I like Titanic. It's a good movie. I don't really have anything to add other than life is hard and full of disappointments. If the earth just opened up and started just coming apart at the seams, yeah, I would think to myself as I plummet to my death, life is hard and full of disappointments. That's being one of them.
That's so true. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Are you Roland Emmerich, and do you want to put us as do you want to mock us by putting us into your next movie and have us die? That'd be sick. Please email us and let us know if you want to do that. That would be awesome.
We'll play ourselves.
Yeah, we would love to play ourselves and die. That would be sick. I referenced this, Ellie. I don't know if you knew this, but
I know what you're talking about, yeah, about Mayor Ebert.
Yes,
and Godzilla.
Ebert and Siskel are, yep, somewhat satired or made fun of in Godzilla, although he doesn't kill him. Bring us back, write that wrong, kill us. Anyway, if you are not Roland Emmerich and you just want to email us...
Although I guess there were no hard feelings because Roger Ebert gave this movie a near-perfect review.
That's crazy. I got to go and read that review because, I mean, 2009... The man was near the end of his life, so maybe he just wanted to see some stuff explode, I guess. He had grown from when he wanted to see 4 hours of someone painting a painting. He's like, now I just want to see John Cusack drive a limo through crumbling Los Angeles. Anyway, send us an email. We're going to be back next week with probably another review. I don't think it's going to be a special episode, but we're cooking that up. It's currently in the works. It'll be coming down the pipeline any day now. But we're going to be back next week, so look forward to that and have a great week in between.